So welcome everyone. So it's a great pleasure to have Bruce Elderman to keep the Strong Gravity seminar today. Bruce is a graduate student from University of Oregon. And I guess he will talk about gravitation wave source inference with data-driven models. Please take it away.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks so much for having me virtually. Super happy to be talking to everyone here today. So yeah, like Juan said, I'll be talking about gravitational wave source inference with data-driven models. So first, I'm just going to flash up this flashy figure of all of the gravitational waves events detected from LIGO Virgo up until now. And this recently just got bigger with the analysis of our O3B, the second half of our third observing run set. These are all of the events added on the bottom in the very the darkest blue. So this culminates in the third gravitational wave transient catalog, which just came out at the end of last year. And you can see there's a whole bunch of types of events we are seeing. Mostly are binary black holes, but there's still a few new binary neutron stars and neutron star black hole events. But it's really enabling some new investigations into things we haven't been able to see before with all of these events. So. So like I mentioned, just at the end of last year, we released these GWTC3 catalog and some accompanying papers. So here's just like the archive codes if anyone's interested for our catalog paper. There's an accompanying population analysis, which I'll actually talk about at the end of this talk because I was pretty involved in that paper. There's another testing GR accompaniment paper, and then a cosmology paper that uses the catalog to measure some cosmological parameters. And on the right here, I just kind of have this plot showing our cumulative number of detections as a versus of time, of observing time. Obviously, we have some breaks in here between wherever these lines are, where detector people spend a lot of effort to increase our sensitivity and stuff. But the really exciting thing is just in this third observing run, you can see the slope and rate of our detections is drastically increased, and we're getting into some really cool regimes to do some science. Okay, so just a quick overview of what I'm going to talk about. So it's kind of 2/2.5 sections to the talk here. So this first section, I'm going to talk about single source inference and parameter estimation that we do to kind of infer properties about all of those events I showed you at the very beginning. And specifically, I'm going to talk about this coherent waveform deviation model that I've developed with some colleagues. Then the second section, I'll move to talking about hierarchical inference, where we're trying to infer properties about the entire population of sources rather than just individual ones, and present two different models that I've worked on in regards to the mass distribution of binary black holes. I will just focus on the mass distribution, but at the end, I'll give you some small teases from some of the stuff that's in our populations paper for GWTC3, and there's lots of interesting stuff besides the mass distribution, so just because I'm not talking about it doesn't mean it's not interesting, just focusing on what I've been working on recently. So it's an overview to the parameters that describe our binary black hole mergers. We have usually, you can consider it a 15-dimensional inference problem where 8 of them are intrinsic parameters. You have the mass of both black holes, where we always define M1, the primary mass, to be the larger one. And then you have a spin vector of each black hole, gives you another 6 degrees of freedom there. And then you have these extrinsic parameters. And on the right here, it just shows a canonical example of a binary black hole merger. You see the chirp waveform in the three regions that we usually talk about, the N-spiral merger and ring down. And this kind of waveform right here is something that would be affected by these intrinsic parameters, while the extrinsic parameters kind of affect how we see the signals in our detectors. So I'll go back and forth between intrinsic and extrinsic a lot. So And I just now mentioned, I forgot to mention at the beginning that if anybody has any questions during this, just feel free to interrupt me. I don't know if I'm going to be able to follow the chat or hands, but I totally don't mind if anyone just speaks up. Okay, so how do we do the parameter estimation? That first plot I showed you had the individual masses just put on there as if we knew them exactly, but that's not the case. We don't know the exact masses of any of these events or any of their parameters. We have pretty noisy data. And so in the presence of this noise, we need to do statistical inference to kind of infer our probability that we can characterize our uncertainty in our measurements of these parameters. So to use this, we use Bayes theorem and use a formulation of Bayesian inference. So this is just normal Bayes theorem here, where our main goal is to, given some stream of observed data, we want to find out what's the probability distribution of observing source parameters theta. So these are masses and spins and sky location, given that this was the data we observed. So this is the inference problem. And then on the right here, this is what is kind of like an output. So these are a paper from the GWTC3 catalog. You can see all the new O3D events. And these little violins show our confidence or our probability uncertainty in what these events are. So these really wide ones we're pretty uncertain about, these chi precession parameter, while we are pretty good at measuring some of the mass for depending on some of these events. So just to break down some of the pieces of this, this is, like I already said, this is the posterior distribution is what we call it. This is usually the goal of all of our inferences. And this is just equal to the likelihood function, which is the probability of observing the data we see given some source parameters. And then we have a prior distribution, which kind of characterizes our a priori expectation for these parameters. And then I'll briefly mention about this evidence, often called or sometimes called the marginal likelihood later. This is really just a normalization factor that normalizes the posterior, but we could use it later to do some nice model comparisons, talk about that. So what's this likelihood function that we use? How do we get that? This is something that you, when you're doing these inferences, you don't really get to choose. You might be free to choose up your prior, but there are definitely right and wrong choices for likelihood. And under our assumption of uncorrelated Gaussian stationary noise, we use this thing called the Whittle likelihood. And it's basically the exponent, and then you take an inner product between the data vector and this model, where k is indexing over frequency bins, and divide out the noise features. So this would be the power spectral density, and that's usually characterized over here. This is actually an amplitude spectral density plot, but you can see our three different detectors here in the network have different sensitivities, where the higher you are, the less sensitive you are on this plot. And you can also see there's a strong frequency structure here to our sensitivity, and that's gonna come into play when we go to hierarchical modeling, because it adds some effect to our what we're sensitive to. So in that likelihood, there's this HK thing. So what is this? This is our model for what the gravitational wave form would look like, dependent on the parameters theta. And I should mention one thing I left off of this whole likelihood here, is that this would be in the case where you had a single detector, but we have multiple detectors. So to do that, and I'm going to jump down, and I now notice that my notation is bad. So up here, K is indexing over frequency bins. Down here, I use K to index over a detector, where the frequency is just indicated here. But anyway, so a detector K, you record data, and you can assume that we have some noise plus a signal, right? And we know fairly well what our noise is. And this signal I'm going to refer to as an observed signal for this detector. So this is not, or this is dependent on the detector K. And we could write this out by just taking the intrinsic plus and cross correlations in the Fourier domain of our signal and multiplying them, projecting them on our what they're called antenna patterns for this detector K. So this is the difference when I mean observed detector is dependent on the observed signal is dependent on the detector and and then intrinsic or coherent signal is this thing that does not depend on the detector. So these are dependent on the intrinsic parameters while the extrinsic parameters are going to affect these antenna patterns. So just as a quick movie overview of how this kind of process or process works in a toy example. So in blue, you see this whitened gravitational wave strain data. In yellow is our prediction. So as we fuddle the total mass, you can get something that fits roughly the wiggles right. And then you can move the distance to get the amplitude modulation to see where it fits. And then lastly, you apply the detector sensitivity to get our final predicted signal that we would see in our detector. So this is what we get. And you can see it matches up pretty well. This is from our first event. GW150914. But in practice, this doesn't go in like some linear fashion like this. We're doing everything at once. We use methods as Markov chain Monte Carlo or nested sampling or other sampling methods to really get at that posterior distribution that I talked about before, which was our main goal. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about like how do we know these models for our waveforms are good enough or correct. We know there's always some systematic uncertainty between them, and obviously solving Einstein's equations is very hard for these types of systems. So one way that we can come up with a way or a method to kind of test this and see where our models agree or not is by parameterizing deviations to the coherent waveform. So this is before any projection across the detector. So what this would basically be able to pick up is if there's excess deviations in the signal that match across both detectors, given how it would be projected. So this is similar to how we model calibration errors in our detector. But the only difference is that this is the coherent signal and not the observed signal that we're applying these smooth deviations or fudge factors to. So there's a few things that this could be sensitive to, or these or possible deviations could be to. So there's just the waveform model systematic errors. It'll be pretty hard to get down to that levels, but maybe when we get to higher SNR regimes. Also more unlikely, but it could be slight subtle deviations from GR that we're picking up in these signals. And the one that's probably most likely that would happen is between these, at least the first and the third, is that maybe there's just some sort of physics that's not included in the waveform model. Like it could be the presence of higher order modes that would be coherent across our network, or for example, if it was some neutron star black hole binary, there could be extreme things like tidal disruption going on that's modifying their coherent waveform. So back to the waveform systematics. So this is our, in the presence of our deviations, we have our coherent waveform and the plus and cross polarizations, which is just the modeled waveform. So this would be any of your GR, DBH models. So IMR, phenom, whatever, if you want those ones. We multiply it by this amplitude factor, one plus delta A. This is a function of frequency that describes the fractional change in amplitude. And then we have this phase factor with a corresponding deviation in phase as a function of frequency. So what do we really want to infer these functions to kind of figure out what the data says about the deviations that are coherent. And two of the things we want are, we want them to be pretty smoothly varying in frequency. We don't want everything to be like jaggy and discontinuity across our deviations. But we also want it to be flexible enough to fit any generic form of possible deviations, because there could be a lot of things and we don't really know what they would look like. They might look differently for different events that are in different frequency ranges, and who knows. So we really want this to be very generic and flexible. So our answer to that is to let the data sort it out. And basically this means use some non-parametric models, and Before I go on, I'm going to talk about non-parametric versus parametric models a lot. And just to clarify, there's kind of a misnomer because there are parameters in non-parametric models, which you might be thinking why when it says non. But the difference is that the number of parameters is pretty much arbitrarily. So these non-parametric models usually have arbitrarily large number of parameters. You can think of them as like Gaussian processes, kernel density estimators, or in my talk today, I'm going to talk mostly about splines. So for our deviation model, we're going to use cubic spline functions to model this delta A and delta phi as a function of frequency. So this weird notation here is just saying this is a cubic spline that interpolates across frequency space given a set of what we call knot locations in frequency space and their height. So we're tying these two knots together. So these two fi are sequences of knots points spaced out in frequency space, and they each are paired with a height and amplitude deviation and a height and the phase deviation.
Bruce?
Yeah, what's up?
Yeah, just a quick question out of curiosity. So what's the reason to go in behind for splines as opposed to wavelets or any other option? So is there a particular reason that it's compelling to go in this direction?
Yeah, so there's a few things. So one of them is they're fairly cheap to evaluate. They kind of fit into our normal infrastructures as well too, because as I mentioned before, this deviation model is something we use to kind of infer the calibration properties of our detectors. And for that model as well, in the past at least, we've moved to some other things now. We used splines for that, and it seemed to work really well. So that was just kind of like the first pass at this, and it seemed to work well, and we kind of like the properties. I will maybe mention a few things that aren't quite as good about them, but in general, this method could be used with any way you want to model these functions, right? Obviously, the things we want are them to be flexible and have some smoothness properties, but that's really all we care about.
Thank you. And well, maybe on that note, so smoothness is mainly, it's a requirement because you would think, if you were to think of something that is non-smooth, then you could be latching onto too many glitches, or is that an underlying assumption?
Yeah, so we wouldn't really necessarily be latching on to glitches because in all of these cases, this we're running on like data that's already been processed and run through normal parameter estimation. And usually in that process, they're going to be removing glitches if there are any present, or if there were glitches, it might have vetoed that event in the first place. But in general, there are noise properties that things can latch on to, such as spectral lines. They have seen that happen. So one of the negative sides about splines that I was going to talk about is if these node points, we actually add them as a parameter so you can freely move, and that kind of generalizes the resolution that of features you can fit. But one of the downsides is if spline points get too close, they can do some crazy things and kind of blow up. And we found that feature can latch on to spectral lines in the data, which obviously messes up your inference. But
all right, thank you.
Cool. Yeah, so what we are adding now is three N parameters, or N is how many knots you want to choose to the model, where so you have N locations in frequency space, the heights for the amp and phase deviations. And these are just the priors that we put on these parameters. So normal prior centered on zero for the deviation heights. And then we uniformly space across our frequency space where the node knot locations start. But like I said, these are free parameters too. So they are allowed to move. We have to do a few things to not allow them to get too close. So we kind of have like a repulsion between them. And then also, they can't reorder themselves, but those are just two subtleties. So that was really the overview of the model. So I'm going to talk about this toy model we constructed to kind of test this out to see, test it to its limits of how much we can really probe deviations with. So this toy model is based on an extreme case of spontaneous scalarization in gravity. And basically the phenomenological effect of this happening is we just have a rapid jump in our phase at roughly 100 hertz. This is very, very rapid. I think the width of this transition is like around 2 hertz. And then at the same time, around 100 or same frequency at 100 hertz, there's this very temporary dip in amplitude. This amplitude dip is very small. It's only around 5% reduction at the peak. And this is just the way we parameterized it. But this is really the key important parts. We have this step function in phase and a small dip in amplitude. So let's see what our model can do with these types of simulations. So first, we start out by simulating just a 1509-14-like signal with an IMR PhenomD waveform model with, of course, no deviations. And then we put this into simulated Gaussian noise according to our power spectral density and fit a model. So this one has no deviations. This is the result we get when we fit our spline deviation model on it. And there's a few things we can see. So first of all, we see it's very symmetric around zero in both of these. We're not really getting any movement in our node locations. They're all kind of uniformly distributed because there's really no preference in the data of where they should be because there is no features for it to fit. And then one small thing, there's this really blowing up feature at high frequencies. This is due to the feature or the fact that the spline knots are located in log space. And as the distance between these knots get larger, you can also have bigger swings. And then the second part is this is at high frequencies and there's no signal in the data at this point. The merger frequency happens for 1509-14, I think around like 200 hertz, something like that. I can't remember around this range. So there's no signal in the data to even constrain anything there, let alone deviations. So let's do the look at the parameters we recover. So we can run this with our spline deviation model and then also without it, with just a normal CBC model. And look at the parameter recoveries, and they both seem to overlap, which makes sense because we're not finding any deviations. And this green crosses are the injected values, and they all lie pretty consistently within our inferred posterior distributions. So at least it looks like our model is working in the case of and in the absence of deviations. Okay, so now we're doing the same, take the same exact signal, but we're going to modify it with that toy model I mentioned above. So we have that 5% dip in amplitude at 100 hertz and a 60 degree phase jump at 100 hertz as well. So you can see that there's some stuff going on. We can already notice that the node locations are kind of clumping around 100 hertz, which is exactly what we would expect. The amplitude prior is really washing out that very small change in amplitude at 100 hertz. That's really not sensitive to that. But the phase deviation we're quite sensitive to. It doesn't quite look like a step function, and there's two reasons for that. So one is that these deviations have a prior that's pretty strongly favoring them towards zero. So if you were to jump up as a step and then try to stay up 60 degree added phase this whole time, that wouldn't really jive well with the prior. And also, like I said, the merger frequency happens at around 200 hertz. So once you get over here, there's no signal in the data. So of course, we're not really going to find any deviations to a signal that's not absent. But the overall jump between this bottom part and up here is very close to 60 degrees. And like I said, here's the histograms of where the node locations, they all jump up around here because there's a sharp feature and the data wants to fit a sharp feature there. And again, let's look at the parameter recoveries. So in pink is without the spline deviation model. And you can see it samples fine. It just does not know which parameters we simulated, which is fine. But when we add in the the deviation model, there's a shift in the location of the posterior. So that's a really a sign that they're doing something, right? And as an added plus, we can see with our spline model, we're kind of recovering in the injected values as we simulated in this signal. So that's also good. So this was an extreme case. We started with that 60 degree phase jump at 100 hertz, but we repeated the same procedure by varying the phase jump, keeping the amplitude the same, the small amplitude dip. So when you vary this from jumps from 0 to 60 degrees and increments of 5, and then we use this deviance information criterion as a model comparison metric. So at each of these simulated signals, we would run the spline model and then a normal CBC model, use the DIC of both of them to figure out which one would be favored from this metric. You can think of this as similarly to a Bayes factor, which we'll talk about later. Also, one note is we chose not to use Bayes factors because they're very sensitive to prior choices in your model. And when you have these non-parametric models or weakly parametric models, there's a lot of arbitrary prior choices that can actually quite significantly affect those things. And this isn't fully free from those effects, the DIC, but it is less prior focused as it's only calculated based on the log likelihood distribution, which I can talk more about if anyone's interested. But the key thing here is that as we increase the jump in phase, our comparison of the two models moves from the red one, which is no spline model favored, and then to once you get to about 20 degrees of phase jump, we start favoring the spline model more and more, which makes sense with what you would expect, especially after we see the spline model considerably finding a different mode in the posterior. So now we can apply the same model to all of the compact binaries in GWTC1. So this was the 01, 02 events. There was 11 total compact binaries. So I'm just showing two of the more interesting.
Sorry, can I ask you a question? Yeah. So what is the time interval like before and after the events that you're including?
So it's roughly the same as was done for the PE. So depending on if we're looking at a binary black hole event or a binary neutron star, we change the segment of data we're analyzing. So for these heavy events like 170729, I'm pretty sure that the segment of data was only about 4 seconds.
Okay.
But we also did this for 170817. And for that one, we had to use a 64-second segment length, which drastically slows down our model, right? Because your segment length kind of determines your frequency resolution.
But that's significantly longer than the merger time, right? So it looks like you are including a large chunk of time then, right?
Sorry, could you say that again?
I think that's significantly longer than the merger time. 16 seconds. You said 16 seconds, right?
Sorry, so for 170817 was 64 seconds, but that one isn't our LIGO's band for very long. But for these heavier BBH events, we use either 4 or 8 seconds, which is matching the same segment of data that the catalog parameter estimation used for their.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I pulled out these two events. The one on the right, 190823, was one of the most symmetric about zero, these events. So this is the one that had the least evidence for deviations, if you will. While the 170729 had kind of the strongest, even though it's very weak, but we do see this sign of some feature going on at roughly 100 hertz, but also zero is perfectly consistent with this posterior if you slice all the way along. And actually, speaking of that, that's another way we can look at these posteriors to combine a lot of events is if we imagine these distributions getting sliced at each frequency bin through the x-axis, the zero line, you can calculate what quantile of the vertical in that frequency bin of the posterior distribution does zero cross through. And
sorry, I see Suadev has a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks. So I have a question regarding when you are inferring these values, are you using only a particular waveform, or are you also changing the waveform models?
So all of these, for this study that was done in this paper, we used, for the BBHs, we used IMRFIN on PEV2. So it was consistent across all of them for the BBHs. And then for the BNS, the 170817, we used IMRFIN on PEV2 in our title to include tidal effects. But those are the only difference. So they were all the same processing IMR family of waveforms.
So how much, if there is an inaccuracy in the waveform modeling, how much that will capture by changing the different waveform models? That also can be explored by this, right?
Yeah. So it definitely could be explored. It's not something that we've gone too deep into yet. We're in the process of working on some other things to kind of reduce the computational cost of this model so that we can actually feasibly apply it to these large catalogs we're getting now. So that's definitely a thing that should be tested, right? We only tested the one IMR family of waveforms, and we have a lot of waveform families, and it would be very interesting to see if where or how multiple waveforms would disagree on the deviations for each event.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's go on to the next slide. Like I was saying, we can calculate the quantiles of the posterior distribution that zero crosses on those plots for each frequency bin. So these start and end at different frequencies because of the different choices in segment length and sample rates for each of the events. But it's kind of hard to see. This mod GR is the simulated signal we did. And you can see it really, amplitude, it is the wiggliest, but it doesn't really go out too far. But in phase, in this region, right before 100 hertz and right after, zero is completely ruled out. There's no support in the posterior for a zero deviation, which is what we'd expect, right, for that model, because we did put a deviation in. And then conversely, you can see the simulated signal with no deviation is this dark black line that really just stays very near 50, which means the deviations or the posterior of our deviations are symmetric around zero. So there definitely is some fluctuation from these events. These are all the 11 events, but none of them rule out zero. And that's kind of the thing that we were looking for mostly. And then the other thing you can look at it, besides just looking at what the values of these deviations from the waveforms are, we can do the same model comparison. So if you look down here in the top bottom left, this is doing the same model comparison that I showed in that red and green plot, but for these events. And for this plot on the left side would be the negative values are no, the spline model is disfavored. And on the right value would be slot spline models favored. So all of these events are roughly either no preference or slightly disfavored. So it's really inconclusive here so far. And this only goes up to the 25. If you recall from my previous plot, the 60 degree phase jump had a DIC difference of around 200 to 300. So it was definitely significantly more favored. And this is pointing to kind of no strong coherent deviations are really detected from these. So that was kind of the end of that first section. And if anybody had any more questions, you can feel free to jump in now, but I am going to be moving to looking now at hierarchical inference, where we're looking to infer properties about the entire population of sources. And specifically, I have two models for the mass distribution that I'll talk about here.
Bruce, can I ask a question about the TDR stuff?
Yep.
Yeah, so the deviations that you look at here, apologies if you said it, did you actually do a hierarchical inference to combine all events, or are you just looking at each individual event separately?
Yeah, so yeah, these are not, no hierarchical model is going on here. This is all individual events. So I imagine that that could be something that could be used. One concern that I have is that I'm not quite sure if one would expect deviations to occur at the same frequencies for these different masked mergers. But that's something that definitely could be explored at some point. Maybe you can pick out some subset of mergers that are quite similar to try to look for some subtle deviation from the waveforms there.
Yeah, you could just scale the frequency by the total mass of the system.
Yeah, that works too. That would actually, that makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can talk about this later.
Cool, yeah. And also, the other thing was that the model is very expensive right now. So hopefully the work we're putting towards making it more computationally effective and optimized will hopefully also enable hierarchical studies with similar models.
Maybe could I ask a related question?
Yeah.
So you said that this modification was at least inspired by spontaneous scalarization. Could you say a little bit more about what the scenario you're thinking of that gives you this jump?
I don't have much to say about it other than I did join this project after that was already like kind of picked as our canonical use case. There's some papers that go into it, and this is definitely a very exaggerated model of what would happen. So I clearly tried to describe it as a toy model because I'm not quite sure how physical it is. But one could imagine we're actually working on testing other more physically motivated simulated deviations. I think I mentioned that one of the other possibilities that we're testing is like to see how the waveforms might get modified from tidal disruptions and neutron star black hole events. I think I'd have to come back to you on that to talk more about that specific toy model motivations.
Okay, just wondering, I mean, do you have a specific modified theory in mind?
I don't. I know there's lots of possible different theories and that they probably all have subtly slightly different predictions for how things might deviate. But yeah, the main motivation behind that was to use something that was like, even if it was unrealistic, that was like ever so slightly motivated by something, but it's still an extreme thing so that we could test the limits of the model really.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so I'll try and quickly go through this, just how we do the hierarchical Bayesian inference. So we're kind of asking slightly different questions when we're looking at the population of sources. So we want to know basically how many of these binary black hole mergers are there out there in the universe. We also want to ask like how often do they merge? What is their merger rates? And then how are their source properties distributed? And that we specifically mean like the true distribution of these events out in the whole universe, not the distributions that we specifically observe. So again, I just have Bayes' theorem here copied down. And we're going to introduce this concept of a hyperprior on the top right. This is a very simple, one of the simple primary mass hyperpriors or population models, which I use interchangeably here, is just a truncated power law. So for example, this is would be the probability of primary mass given hyperparameters, which for this case would be what's the power law slope and where are the mass cutoffs. We're now not really trying to infer these individual event source properties anymore, but our goal is to infer these hyperparameters that are common across all of the events that govern this population distribution. So when we move from this P of theta given D to taking the hyperparameters, we can just integrate the likelihood over thetas to get that out. And this specifically was if you had one event, but we'd have a catalog of events, right? There's not just one set of data. We have lot of them, and we'd assume for them to be independent of each other so we can multiply their likelihoods to get our hyperposterior on the hyperparameters given a set of a catalog of data. So again, this is just taking that likelihood part right here and multiplying it for each of the events where I is indexing over all the observed events. So you have different data, different sets of source parameters for them. And again, you also have a corresponding evidence that normalizes this whole posterior. And as I mentioned before, one of the things we have to carefully take into account when we're doing these hierarchical studies is the selection effects, which is common in most electromagnetic surveys and things. But so the gravitational wave detection efficiency depends on these parameters. So for more distant sources, we can only detect louder sources because of the distance of the amplitude fall off with distance. And then we also have a strong dependence on mass because heavier mass BBHs merge at lower frequencies. And as we remember that noise curve I showed at the very beginning, you have that sharp rise at low frequencies, and that can really limit how many cycles the mergers will stay in our sensitive band. So both of these have strong effects on our sensitivity. But if we're trying to infer how many binary black hole mergers and what their rate are out in the whole universe, then we kind of need to know these selection effects. So because of that, we can say that the number of our observed BBHs should be dependent on what their parameters are, right? So this is basically equivalent to saying the numbers of these observed things are inhomogeneous Poisson processes, where the Poisson rate depends on these parameters. So taking our posterior, hyperposterior from last slide right here, and now including an extra parameter, which is the total number of binary black holes in the universe, and because it's an inhomogeneous Poisson process, this part here on the end is that Poisson likelihood, and then you have the prior, where the rate is given by the detection efficiency given some population described by lambda times the total number of binary black holes. So first of all, so this P detect is not trivial to calculate. So we need to calculate this integral over all data that passes our detection threshold of all the likelihoods and the hyperpriors. And this can be pretty expensive. And another thing is this integral, or this hyperposterior right here, depends on this integral over the likelihood function. And if you know anything about our gravitational wave single event inference, calculating these likelihoods can be very slow and challenging at some points. So if we're trying to calculate likelihoods over all of the, or integrating over all of the source parameters for each of the events all at once, that can be very computationally expensive. But luckily for us, we can use important sampling to compute both of these integrals with Monte Carlo integrals. So to talk about that specifically, the catalog PE that I talked about will release posterior samples. So that's not quite the likelihood that we need. But because we used a sufficiently wide agnostic uninformative prior when we do our initial parameter estimation, we can use this important sampling by taking the numerical average of the posterior samples weighted by the PE prior, the uninformative prior. And we can use this basically because this is a very wide prior, the PE, like we said, uninformative agnostic, while our population model is going to be more informed. So we can do the important sampling here to effectively undo this prior and get at the likelihood without having to recalculate anything. So that makes our inference possible. And then the other thing was for the integral and the p-detect. To calculate this, we use what's called injection sets. So these are a bunch of simulated signals that we inject or put into real data. Then that all gets ran through our normal search pipelines that produce the triggers for the real events and the catalogs. And we can figure out how many of these injections and where in parameter space did we detect them. So that same integral can also be formulated as this important sampled or Monte Carlo integral over the injection sets. So now these theta I are the parameters of the injections, and the sum only sums over the found injections, which means the injections that our search line are found, or search pipelines found and met our threshold. And then we correspondingly divide out the prior or the draw probability from where these injections came from. And you can imagine if our population model and our draw probability, so that say we drew our injections from the exact same population model as we're trying or evaluating here, then this detection efficiency is just the how many did you find over how many total injections were there, which should make sense. Okay, so that's how we calculate these things. So this full Piper posterior is now what we want for our hierarchical situation. And we can just plug this into our normal Bayesian samplers and MCMC nested sampling or whatever have you to draw samples from this posterior and calculate likelihoods. So now I'm going to talk about specific mass models that we use. So this is a family from the GWTC2 populations paper, not the third one that came out recently, but these are four sketches of the phenomenological simple models that we've been using. And they each have these different features that we add in kind of little by little, and each to kind of investigate certain regions of the population and kind of what can we learn about the disaster physics. So for example, there's this low mass cutoff. Is it sharp? Is it smooth? This kind of gets us to answer the question of like, what is the minimum black hole mass if there is one? And is there a sharp gap between the neutron star masses and black holes, or is this populated? So that's kind of what these low mass features kind of tell us when we're investigating those. Again, we can look at the high mass feature, and is this a sharp cutoff, or is this maybe some break to some shallow power law at high masses? So this kind of gets at the fact of a para-instability supernova. So this picture I have on the right here shows that if you have really massive stars that start out at greater than 130 at zero age main sequence, they can have enough energy inside them to produce these electron positron pairs. And that process takes energy, which then decreases the outward pressure. So the star collapses, and this happens very quickly and efficiently and explodes into such a massive explosion that all the mass gets disrupted and sent out and there's no remnant behind. So what this effectively is saying is, if these black holes we observe are coming from some normal stellar evolution, then there is some black hole mass where we would expect to not see any more black holes. And that's what we call the para-instability mass gap or upper mass gap. Okay, and then a few of the other features is maybe there's peaks in our distribution. So could be a peak. So one of the possible explanations for a peak would be a pileup of mergers from pulsational para-instability. So this is a similar phenomena, but for slightly lighter stars with 80 to 130 zero age main sequence masses. So the same thing happens. You create massive enough to create electron positron pairs, but when it first explodes, it doesn't completely disrupt itself. It sheds off a lot of mass and then can restabilize. And if it's still massive enough, it can create electron-positron pairs again and explode again, shedding off some more mass. And this could happen one, two, or three times or so. And once it finally sheds off enough mass, it is not massive and energetic enough to produce electron-positron pairs, and it'll end its life as a core collapse supernova and producing a normal remnant black hole. So this effect basically has a wide range of initial stellar masses that should produce all similar black hole masses slightly before a possible cutoff to the para-instability supernova gap. And then you could also add, maybe there's another peak because we could be seeing things from hierarchical mergers if we're in tense dynamical environments, and maybe there's another one there. So these are the different phenomenological features we look for. So quickly, from the lessons we learned from GWTC2 population was that initially this truncated power law, the simplest model we found, is no longer consistent with the data. And specifically, it's because we're seeing a lot more heavy mass events. So you can see we inferred a maximum mass around 40, 45 in GWTC1. When we added our large GWTC2 catalog, this jumped up to be nearly 80, almost entirely inconsistent with that first distribution. And then we can pull out the most massive event, 0521, which I'm going to talk more about in a little bit. And that could still give us a much higher maximum mass than GWTC1. And it's because these other two events are also very massive. And then here on the right, I'm showing just the inferred distributions for those four Tori illustrations of these models. And so, like we said, the truncated model is no longer consistent with our data. You can see that by these Bayes factor comparisons at the bottom, as showing that the power law peak is our most favored model, favored over multi-peak by about 2 to 1, so not very strongly, and then about 8 and 9 to 1 over the broken power law. But the consistent thing that is found is that there is some feature at 35 Vissel masses. It seems to be more likely described by a peak at around 35 mass, solar masses, but it could also equally be described by some break at maybe 40 solar masses to a more shallow power law. And then in addition to that, GWTC2 found that there seemed to be quite a lack or a dearth of low mass black holes less than 6 solar masses. So I'm going to jump back to talking about one of the more interesting events from GWTC2, 0521, and it's really massive, and basically the effect of that had is very short-lived in our detector sensitivity band, so we have very few cycles to analyze this signal, and long story short, that's led to tons and tons of explanations of, or different possible explanations for the signal. And people are really looking for those because, for example, we talked about this parent stability gap, and these two black squares right here are where the LVC analysis inferred both component masses, which are both quite squarely and very consistent with being in this forbidden region that's gray or hashed gray, as expected from population synthesis simulations. Great. So, yeah.
Let me ask you, so you had that a few slides ago, sorry, didn't catch you. The dearth of low mass black holes, but given that you have, what is it, two events that they've been labeled as binary neutron stars or binary star companion without any other evidence except theoretical bias or observational bias from EM, is that, what happens if you consider that those systems are binary black holes? I mean, there is a strong bias that inputs, there is nothing below 2 solar masses, and which you would label a black holes. So I'm just wondering, how would you go about testing that hypothesis?
Yeah, so that's definitely something that has been more in people's minds in our groups recently. And specifically, we're just now kind of getting more of these low mass observations and things. For example, there's like the secondary in what 190814, which we kind of referenced as an outlier event, where it's like 2.6 or 2.8 solar masses. Like, we don't really know what that could be. It could be a very, really, really light mass or black hole or something else. But one of the things I'll briefly mention when I talk about our GWTC3 analysis is that we've recently done fully consistent analyses of the merger rate across all compact object masses. So it's like combining all of these neutron stars and black holes individually. And that's giving us some more information about the lower mass gap. And I'll just hint at you right now that this seems to be filling out more and more the more we see. And it's also expected because there's such low sensitive volume for our searches at these low masses that there's going to be a higher uncertainty in what we can infer right there. So,
but I guess my question is, if we keep insisting on assuming that there is a lower mass gap and that LIGO doesn't see the frequencies that objects in that lower mass gap would have, wouldn't see the merger to tell them apart, then wouldn't we just be focusing on only one possibility, and that just comes from our bias?
Yeah, so I think I agree with what you're saying. And I think things are rapidly changing among a lot of the people, at least I've talked to, about kind of their view on this lower mass cap. And like I mentioned about this, the joint analysis of all these compact objects we've found is that it seems like there's this really sharp drop in merger rate after you reach the massive, the maximum mass of neutron stars at roughly like 2.5 is I think what we're inferring, which might be kind of high, but there's this really massive drop in merger rate there. But what they aren't finding is that there's no like subsequent sharp rise to where you would say the beginning of these BBH distributions are. I think there's a lot of things that we don't know yet. And I think a lot of it is driven by observational bias and also just modeling uncertainties too. All of these models right here include some hard minimum mass truncation. And maybe that's not a good assumption to make now that we're starting to see a lot of these weird light mass events.
All right, thank you.
So just the last thing I think I said was that the two components of 190521 lie pretty squarely in this supposedly forbidden range if we were expecting them to come from or be formed by normal stellar evolution. But there's been a lot of disagreement in how people can analyze this event. So starting here from the left is a paper by Maya Fischbach and Dan Holtz that came out recently after the announcement of this, that you can look at the shaded regions are regions that are expected for parent stability gap for M1 and M2. This purple bluish distribution was the normal uninformative PE results from LEC's analysis. But you can now use the information we gained from learning about the population. And what Maya did here in this paper was to force that the secondary comes from this previous population distribution that had this truncation at 20 or 45 solar masses. And if you do that, we measure the total mass pretty well in our detectors. So if you kind of force the secondary of this event to most likely lie below 50 solar masses or whatever, you get a lot more support for higher primary masses. And you see that with that population formed prior, there's roughly like half of the posterior support for this mass gap straddling region, which means possibly the primary mass could be above the gap and the secondary below. And there's some other evidence for this too. So this was just using LVC's results, but with a population formed prior. So this paper from Alex Nitz and Colin Campano at AEI, they used an updated new waveform, this XPHM that was not available when the LIGO did their things, and they found this high mass ratio mode. So it's another more evidence it could be mass gap straddling. This waveform was a little bit too new for them to be used. The bugs were found later, and there's been reanalysis done. So this one, the most recent one, I think, Dimla, Hector, Steli, and others. So they compared what Nitz and Campano found with the XPHM to these fixed versions, and the story is similar but different in that they don't find quite as high of a mass ratio mode, but there's still support here, which is still mass gap straddling region, and these stars are also the highest likelihood or maximum likelihood points. So it's also interesting that the maximum likelihood is in this mass gap straddling regime, So what we wanted to test in this paper for me and some my advisor and postdoc Zohair, doctor, was is there support in the population for there to be a mass gap if you assume, or depending on what you assume about 190521, right? So these are kind of shows the whole population of GWTC2 and M1M2 or in total and mass ratio, inverse mass ratio space. And in purple shows the LVC estimates for 0521. And at this time, only the Nitz and Gapano results were out. So it's what we used as our alternative explanation, which you can see also show lots of region here in this mass gap straddling place. So we just took some simple models that were used, the truncated and parallel peak, and we put in a parameterized mass gap, just two parameters of where it starts and how big the width is, and we zeroed out the merger rate and the gap for both the mass ratio and the primary mass. And then we ran on both the sets using 0521 and then the other, or the, using the LVC results versus using Nitz and Gapano, see what we get. So when we use a truncated model, I'm sorry, I think I'm running out of time. I'm trying to speed up here. With the LVC results, there's mild evidence for some mass gap here from these at these ranges. But when we use the Nitz and Gapano results, we get pretty strong evidence for which is a log base factor of 6.5 for a mass gap, and pretty uncertain constraints on the bounds of the gap. But it's kind of promising that you kind of see these roughly where we expect for theory to be. But if you expect there to be a feature from pulsational or apparent stability gap, you might also expect there to be a pulsational pile up. So what if we use the parallel peak underlying model instead of the truncated model? Well, in that case, we kind of get a different story. With the LVC results, we have slightly no preference or slightly disfavoring the gap versus slightly favoring the gap. These are pretty, very inconclusive though. And that was kind of the takeaway from this paper is that depending on the mass distribution and also just on your estimates for 0521, there could be a support for a gap already, even though we have very, very little observations in this high mass regime. Okay, I'm going to jump through pretty fast so I don't take any more of your time. This next section is talking about this semi-parametric model for the mass distribution. And this is taking a lot of the same ideas from that first waveform deviation model we discussed. But in this case, instead of our underlying model being a waveform model, it is this simple truncated power law distribution where we then modulate it with some simple spline function again. And you can see this is what the deviations would look like in this just a cartoon description of what it looks like. And we motivated this because it lets us kind of absorb things that we understand well, like a power law form for the broadband structure of our mass distribution, while at least allowing us to be open to surprises by what else could be in there by this non-parametric component, which we call the spline modulations on top. So combining this parametric model, non-parametric model, we have what we call semi-parametric. Again, you have two model specifications where you have how many nodes controls how wiggly you want these modulations to be, and you can control the width of these priors about zero to see how strong you'd like them to be. Let's keep going. In this plot, so we just use base factors and DIC comparison again to motivate what choices of nodes to use, and we can see that as you start to add more nodes, your preference starts to fall off, right? So when you get up to 15, you're fitting the best, you have the highest likelihood. As you add more knots or knots to the model, you might fit the likelihood slightly better, but in base factors and DIC, there's an Occam's penalty. So if you have a more flexible model, you're gonna get penalized. So if this does gain any more likelihood, you're starting to get penalized by adding an extra dimensions to your model. So it kind of motivates that around this plateauing region is where we want our model to be. And specifically, we can also run with all of these and then just combine the posterior samples in a post-processing step based on their ratios of their evidences or their base factors. So that's what we did in this plot. So this is the results here for GWTC2 mass distribution. So in green, you have just the LBC power law peak model. And then we have our, in blue, the power law plus flying model is what we call it. And this at the bottom shows you where our observations lie in primary mass. And you can see we match up really well with this 35 solar mass peak. And we see this increase at 10 solar masses. That might be something interesting, but there's less observations here, right? So we're more uncertain here, especially because of the low sensitivity that we have. So we're not going to get observations as quickly here as we might over here. And then this is also showing two choices for our strength of perturbations, right? If you expect them to be fairly small, you'd get something like this. But if you say we can have really large perturbations, then you might have something like this. And like I said, for those plots before, we combined from three different runs. The effect that that has is that you can see in the regions where in mass space, these three models agree. The combined model agrees really well. That's where it's pretty sure about these deviations. But there's some regions like right here where they all kind of disagree. It's because there's some noise fluctuations and model fluctuations. But the result of combining them with their evidence ratios means you really get a flattened out overall distribution, which is pretty nice because that means we're really unsure about what's going on in this region.
I have a question regarding yes. that. Apologies for the late question.
No.
You have a model with 50 knots and then many, many parameters that it seems a priori quite weird to use that model and claim it as any physics. What happens if you say use a third of the data to do something to find the model parameters and then use the other two thirds to test it as they would do it in machine learning? Is that kind of subsumed by Bayesian modeling? Or is that an independent test that you could do?
Yeah, so I'm not quite sure. I have a feeling that in our, at least comparatively to most machine learning approaches, we're in a not data-rich environment, is what I want to say. So the catalog here has, 46 binary black holes. And because of that small number, I have a suspicion that if you split it up to try to do something like that, you would get more effects due to these small number sampling statistics. But yeah, that could be something more useful in regimes later when we get more events. But that's just a guess. I haven't tried it.
I would guess that most people would simply not believe anything that you do with polynomials or splines with 15 knots. And how many parameters are there? Probably 12 or 13 parameters that you can choose. Maybe even yeah. locations of the knots. So many parameters, you can fit anything. So I'm just worried about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's definitely worries about that. And we take extra care in validating these non-parametric or weakly parametric models because what you're describing is that they can fit anything. And that's partly why we want to use them, because we want to be open to anything and we want them to be able to be generally flexible. But with that trade, you do need extra care to ensure, like you said, that you're not just fitting statistical fluctuations or you're not fitting things that aren't really representative of your data. And to do that, usually what we do is posterior predictive checks. And so in that case, what you can do is you can take a model, simulate what you would observe or simulate events, observations from that model and see how that matches up with our real observations, right? And in that case, we do get, and for these spline models, we get a lot more variance in our posterior predictive checks, but they are not inconsistent. Is what I should say. And then if I have time to reach to the answers from GWTC3, you'll see that we've been applying multiple similar non-parametric or flexible approaches that are all independent, doing different things and finding similar things. And that at least will hopefully build a little bit of confidence among people about the reality of these features.
Thank you.
Okay, so really I'm almost done. Apologies for taking so long. I just have a few slides. I wanted to show the outputs of what we had done in the GWTC3 population analysis. So specifically, some of the new things in the mass distribution is our new observations in blue seem to match up fairly well with what we predicted from GWTC2, which is these black contours. You can also see that we're now finding a much steeper power law in the primary mass, but a shallower power law and mass ratio. So we are finding a more a higher fraction of more unequal mass ratio events, but not too significant. And then here's the application of some of these flexible models that we did in this paper, which is pretty new. So if you see this green model is some binned Gaussian process model, which is kind of, you can think of it as a histogram model with some smoothing effects across the bins. And then in orange was another non-parametric model, which was based on Gaussian mixture model. But they primarily model in chirp mass. This is projected onto the primary mass distribution. That one also has just as many, if not more, or both of those have just as many, if not more, parameters than the power loss blind model. And then in blue is the power loss blind model applied to GWTC3. And then for comparison, pink is the parallel peak model. But the takeaway here is what I wanted to say is that these three independent approaches, while they aren't perfectly in agreement, you can see that there are regions where they do agree. And that is at least somewhat confidence building for us that there are some new features that are appearing in the mass distribution. And specifically, the features that we saw hints of in GWTC2 just previously have now persisted and, if anything, gotten more apparent when we looked at GWTC3. And then some other lessons learned. I just wanted to mention that there was a lot more in this populations paper that I didn't talk about because I was focusing on the mass distribution. And we learned some interesting stuff. Specifically, the merger rate seems to increase with redshift confidently now and fairly similarly to what the predicted for the SAR formation rate. We're seeing presence of misaligned spins in our population, which could give insights into these formation channels of the compact objects we're observing. There also seems to be a correlation in between the chi effective and mass ratio in our population, which could also point signs towards different formation channels. And then here's a plot kind of looking at the drop fall off in rate from neutron star masses leading up to the beginning of the merger rate for black hole, binary black hole range. And you can see that that fall off, but not necessarily a rise. So we're wondering, getting close to really fully describing and modeling this lower mass gap to challenge what we've seen before. And just lastly, I'll conclude here and say this sharp increase is only going to get sharper in 04. We're going to start later this year, hopefully. And there's going to be a lot more to come and a lot more interesting things to investigate in our population. And I imagine we'll be surprised a lot. And I think these methods of doing data-driven models and semi-parametric modeling will become more useful as we get into the higher event regime. So I'll end there. Thank you for letting me go over a few minutes.
Hey, thank you, Bruce, for the very nice talk. And yeah. Will has a question, I guess.
Thanks for the nice talk. So this peak in the distribution, or at least tentative peak in the binary black hole distribution at 35 solar masses that you keep mentioning, that's pretty intriguing. Are there any like proposed astrophysical explanations or population synthesis models that give you that peak?
So that is interesting, and this was first originally proposed, like I think I briefly alluded to, was to explain the pileup of pulsational parent stability supernova before the parent stability gap. But if you expect that and expect from all of like the simulations and theoretical expectations, it should be at higher masses than it is. It's kind of surprising that this is that it would be at 35 solar masses rather than 40 or 45. So I think that's still the best bet on probably what that peak would be due to. But I'm not quite sure what to make of the fact that it's pretty significantly lower than most theorists and stellar evolution people really would like that to be. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks.
Any other questions? Niyash?
So thanks a lot for a nice talk. So I guess the part of it that it wasn't clear to me is if you use Bayesian evidence criterion, basically you're adding a lot of parameters. And I mean, the Bayesian evidence tells you at what point you're adding too many parameters. Basically, if you add too many, then your Bayesian evidence keeps going down. So yeah. I mean, do you stop where that happens? Or I mean, how do you decide where you stop? Is that the criterion?
Yeah, so that is the criterion for when we would stop adding the parameters. And one thing I do want to caution is that we don't use the Bayesian evidence or Bayes factors to compare these non-parametric models to the simple parametric models because of the such increased flexibility and the arbitrary prior choices. They aren't very realistic. But when we're comparing different numbers of knots or nodes from this power loss blind model to the other versions of it, then it kind of makes sense in that it tells us when we find that trade-off of fitting the data the best without too much flexibility.
But then the number of knots that you go from like 5 to 10 to 20, mm-hmm. I mean, do you stop when the Bayesian evidence starts going down, or so is like 20 the maximum Bayesian evidence, or is it not correct?
So for this case, we did stop at 20 because it started to go down. We had done more than 20, and the downward trend continues. So this is basically where we stopped. And these three, the 10, 15, and 20, were the three that we used to combine to make our what we call our final result, where it's not quite like fully marginalizing over the number of knots, but you could think of it that way in like a post hoc ad hoc sense.
So that parameter you were plotting, was that the Bayesian evidence?
Yes. So the orange bars are the spline model compared to the truncated model. And the blue is the same with the DICE comparison. These dotted lines show you what the power law peak model, the fiducial model, is compared to the power law. So this five nodes is fitting worse than the power law peak. And then once we get to 10, 15, 20, it fits better, but that doesn't mean it's more correct than that. We have a very flexible model and it can fit it better.
But do you get the penalty when your parameters increase? I guess that's...
So there is a penalty. So both the Bayes factor and the DIC have that Occam penalty. So the Bayes factor happens from your prior volume. So you integrate your likelihood times the prior over the all parameter space. And that's where that penalty comes in. This penalty comes in an effective sample size term, but that's really just the variance of the log likelihood distribution. So when you add more and more parameters, to some point, your log likelihood distribution is going to have bigger variance. It's that the bias variance trade-off going on.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
All right. And the... more questions for Bruce? Well, if not, let's thank Bruce again.
Thank you.